The week and a half I've been here, what we've been exploring are issues of racism and sexism. We've taken a look at models of ethical leadership, and all of it kind of aimed at how do we change a culture? How do we begin the work of transforming a culture that is, in some ways, by its very nature, oppressive to people? We've identified that the culture, by its very nature, is oppressive to women. It's oppressive to people of culture, of color. It's oppressive to gays and lesbians. It's oppressive to people in the two-thirds world, as Jack Nelson Ballmeyer describes what we normally call the third world. Enough of dwelling on the problem. I think we've spent enough time doing that. What I'm interested in doing in the next three sessions is talking a little bit about how do we begin to undo this? How do we begin the process of creating a more just culture? And you might be a little bit surprised that I think the first step is service. And that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. Trying to come up with a catchy title. So the healing balm of service, you know, picture racism and sexism and heterosexism as infections in the American culture, and they're festering. And what we need is some sort of healing balm to draw out the poison so that some real healing can take place. And I think that's the role of service. I'd like to start by doing something a little bit participatory and ask you, and some of you might have done this last week, but I'd like you to turn to, why don't we say two other people, get into groups of threes, and just for a couple minutes do this. Talk about a time when someone took advantage of you. And after everybody tells that story real quickly, what I want you to do then is to figure out what's common in your stories. There'll be different stories about how you were taken advantage of, but explore for a minute after you've heard all the stories how they're common. And we'll talk about that in just a bit. Go ahead and do that. Would I be imposing a word on any of you if I also put in the word powerless? Okay. Let's move on. I want you to tell another story. This time I'd like you to recall a story in which you took advantage of someone. I always like watching the eyes. You know, when I say the first one, people go, oh, yeah, I remember that. And as soon as I ask this question, people go, who, me? If you're having difficulty coming up with a story, think about your children. Think about your brothers and sisters. Think of a story when you took advantage of someone. As you're telling these stories, think about the feelings that they conjure up.
I don't know why I did it, but I did know.
Just a couple more minutes. Okay, 1 minute. Okay, let me interrupt. I'm working around this drawing here. My son Nicholas helped me set up and drew this for me and asked me if I'd leave it up during the session, so I'm trying to work around it. What I'd like to do now, same thing, is just to list some adjectives based on feelings around these stories. So let's just do that again. Whenever you're ready, take a few seconds if you need to focus on those feelings, and then let's begin to list those.
Guilt.
Guilt.
Embarrassed.
Embarrassed. Talk about embarrassed a little bit. Can you give me?
Well, just as I'm telling, it was such a silly little story, but just as I'm telling my group this story, I just felt my face get hot, like, oh, I can't believe I did that.
Yeah, kind of, what a stupid fool I am.
Yeah.
This is an example of how the victim further victimizes themselves. You know, we have a culture that oppresses women or people of culture or gays and lesbians, and instead of getting angry at the culture, sometimes one of our first tendencies is to feel like it somehow is our fault. And the victim further embarrasses or further victimizes themselves. Okay, let's keep going.
Except that
she wasn't the victim.
I wasn't the victim.
Oh, I'm sorry. I meant to say that when somebody mentioned embarrass over here. Yeah. I'm getting mixed up. Thanks. Okay.
I was just curious if people came up with things. We really struggled in our group to come up with anything stronger than a sort of letting somebody who really wanted to do it even though it was our job. And that, I just wonder, did everybody else come up with some really rash thing they'd done?
Okay, let's talk about that a little bit. I'm going to put that down here. Difficulty to come up with examples. Okay. What are some other feelings?
Ashamed.
Ashamed? Okay.
Kind of in control.
Yeah. Okay, powerful and control. Thank you. Yeah, as fleeting as those might be, that's how we feel for a while.
Lost?
Lost. L-O-S-S.
Okay, lost. Talk about that one a little bit.
Well, I betrayed a friend.
Okay.
And nothing scandalous, but I betrayed and gave away a confidence and got called on it, and I really had to build a trust again. I lost a friend for the moment.
So the breaking of relationships often associated with the feelings of guilt too. Okay. Anything else? Right, let's stop there for a moment.
Confused.
Okay. Let's stop it. I'm sorry.
Well, later. Now we'll talk about it.
No, even, you know, sometimes sort of like is this the right thing to do? Well, yeah, I kind of want to do it, but you know, like sort of.
Okay. let's take a look at these lists for a moment. What I'm going to suggest, approaching this subject like this is important because all of us have been in situations where we've been taken advantage of, and I call these our down categories. In terms of power relationships, these are our down categories. And when we're down, we feel violated, hollow, manipulated, angry, surprised, frustrated, embarrassed, invisible, you know, terrifically powerful words here. Betrayed, pain, and powerless. We also have our up categories. Two interesting things to note. Number one, it was difficult, more difficult for this group to come up with examples where you took advantage of others. And that's in part, I'm sure, based on the fact that not many of you do that a lot, but I'm sure all of us have at some point. But we tend to block those out of our memory. We would prefer not to know those. We would prefer not to be in touch with that because they create all these feelings. You know, kind of a psychological numbing goes on. We don't like to feel guilty or embarrassed. So selective cognizance, you know, we kind of repress those. Two things happen, though, for ups. And in this room, if you're white, you're in an up category because of people in color. If you're a heterosexual male, you're in an up category for the ways in which the culture oppresses gays and lesbians and women. But notice that there's a sense of power, but guilt. And that describes a lot of the feelings when I get to talk to my non-gay white friends, white male friends, is a real sense of this guilt and power. Ups typically don't know that they're taking advantage of people when they are. Downs usually know that they're being taken advantage of. How many of you almost instantaneously knew that you were being taken advantage of? Okay, takes a little time sometimes, but after a while, downs really know what's going on, and that's where all of these feelings come from. So what I like to refer to downs is downs are smart downs. They know what's going on in the world. And as a matter of fact, that was represented by the amount of time it took for you to think of a story. I just heard people clicking all over the place. We tend to be aware of when we're being taken advantage of. You weren't as aware of your up categories, and I call that dumb up. Here's what happens. You know, we go into our up categories, and that's, for instance, women. Women are in a down category when we're talking male-female relations. But if we start talking culture issues, women move from a down category to an up category. Let's take white men, for example, white heterosexual men. They're normally in up categories all the time. So white men, who I know, go around acting like dumb ups. And what that means is that we act in ways, we forget what it was like to be a down, and we act in ways unconsciously that support the systems that oppress. Does that make sense? It's a point I want to linger on if we need to, because I don't want to move on until we... You see, this is the problem. We have people who are being taken advantage of by a system, by an institution that requires people to perpetuate this system in their daily lives by forgetting what it was like to be a down. Okay? That's what happens. Now we're going to talk about a couple different things. But first of all, I want to read you a little statement about us. One last point. So the goal for dumb ups, okay, is to remember what it was like to be a down and to become smart ups. The way you become a smart up is you remember what it was like to be a down, and you take those sensitivities and awarenesses into your up categories, and you act based on those awarenesses. You act with sensitivity, knowing what it was like to be oppressed, knowing what it was like to be taken advantage of. You act in your power categories in ways that are sensitive to those memories. Does that make sense? Dan?
This sort of sounds like what the prophets are always telling Israel to do.
Absolutely.
When you were a slave in Egypt.
Bingo. And I think a lot of it is a lot of Christ's message, and we're going to be talking about those a little bit, have to do with how to be a smart up. You know, in the parables, the heroes are always the people who are least respected in the culture. You know, the notion being that the people who know what it's like to be a down have a lot to teach us. OK? Okay? Here's an example of someone being a smart up. This is a woman writing about the need to be cross-culturally sensitive, and she's writing it from the perspective of trying to create a women's studies program to bring awareness and sensitivity to the otherwise kind of male-based curriculum. And so knowing what it's like to be a down as a woman, not seeing a lot of women's studies stuff in the curriculum, she uses those insights, and listen to what she says. Writing this paper has been difficult. Despite warm receptions for the talks on which it's based, etc. For describing white privilege makes one newly accountable. She's talking about white privilege here as a white woman. As we in women's studies, right, smart down, work to reveal male privilege and ask men to give up some of their power, so one who writes about having white privilege must ask, having described it, what will I do to lessen it or end it? Her sensitivity, becoming a smart up, gives her new accountability. That's why most ups remain dumb. It's because ignorance is bliss. And we don't have to be accountable for the world in which we participate in creating. Is this making sense? Okay. So I'm going to be going over some words on the posters in just a bit, but let me throw some out to you. Dumb ups have unearned advantage. Okay? Unearned advantage. Smart downs have earned strength. Unearned advantage, earned strength. This was given to people based on an institution that is biased. This was earned by people who survive in an institution that's biased. Okay? Another quote from this same piece about unearned advantage. This is a wonderful metaphor, and for all of us in our up categories, but again, especially for heterosexual white males, please listen to this. This is a woman writing. I have come to see white privilege as an invisible package of unearned assets, which I can count on cashing in every day, but about which I was meant to remain oblivious. Okay, that's the secret. As long as white men, heterosexual white men, are not aware that the culture is biased towards them, we walk around oblivious to these unearned advantages. And that's the role. That's what our culture is trying to do, so that white men won't feel guilty. Okay, we try to repress that. White privilege, here's the beautiful metaphor. White privilege is like an invisible, weightless knapsack of special provisions, assurances, tools, maps, guides, code books, passports, visas, clothes, compasses, emergency gear, and blank checks. A weightless knapsack of special provisions. That's what dumb ups carry with them. We like to think of them as things that we've earned. We like to think of them as things that belong to us. We like to think of them as things, if people were only as smart as us, you know, the Protestant work ethic, they could have what we have. But they're culturally given, and they're unearned advantages.
What's interesting about that, Bill, it helps me with something, which is people make the argument that affirmative action programs equalize things. What's useful about the metaphor is maybe that's true, but an affirmative action program is a weighted knapsack. It's not weightless.
Okay.
Because you are burdened by having gone through that program with being, you know, with people having in the back of their mind saying, you didn't really...
That's right. You wouldn't be here.
You wouldn't be here.
If it weren't for this program.
Right. So okay. That's a nice... That metaphor really helps,
That's an excellent point, And people who come into organizations through affirmative action, that's an excellent point, really carry the burden of that sort of stigma with them. Okay. Think about the ways in which you carry an individual knapsack with you. This woman, in an attempt...
Excuse me.
Yes,
I
Betty.
Missed that. Okay. I don't know what...
Let me be clear. Often what happens to somebody who's gotten into a job or a educational institution as a result of them being a woman or them being a person of color, okay, is that everybody knows it. Everybody knows that they're there because they've had that advantage, okay? Bill was talking about the advantage that you have because, you know, you're white and a man, that nobody talks about that as being something that you automatically get. It's weightless. It's sort of just there. Whereas when you get your advantages through that other means, somehow you have to pay for the fact that you had that advantage. That's what I'm trying to say.
This is the process, what I'm about to read you, about how this woman moved from being a dumb up into a smart up, okay?
A dumb up to a smart up.
Oh. This is how she made that transition. When she sat down in preparation for this article, she said, if this is true, if I have this weightless knapsack of unearned advantages that I can tap into, I ought to be able to come up with some examples. And so she came up with 46. Okay, if you'd like, I've selected a few. Some of these are amazing. I never considered them until I read them, right? Dumb up. I'm a dumb up. I didn't ever consider these things as advantages. And this is now written in the cultural context. So these are advantages that whites have in American culture. Listen to some of these. I can go shopping alone most of the time, pretty well assured that I will not be followed or harassed. I can turn on the television or open the front page of the paper and see people of my race widely represented. Just skipping around here. I can be sure that my children will be given curricular materials that testify to the existence of their race. I can go into a music shop and count on finding the music of my race represented, into a supermarket and find the staple foods which fit my cultural traditions, into a hairdresser shop and find someone who can cut my hair. Unearned advantage. I do not have to educate my children to be aware of this systemic racism for their own daily physical protection. I told a story earlier. My oldest son is homemade. My second son is adopted and from Korea. Never thought about warning him about going off to school. And in his first week of kindergarten, he came home with tears. And I said, "What's wrong, Ben?" Someone told me that I have funny eyes today. Okay. I never thought about the need to prepare him for that. I probably should have. I can do well in a challenging situation without being called a credit to my race. I am never asked to speak for all people of my racial group. Chuck, what do you think white men think about this? Okay, it's things that we don't do, okay? I can be pretty sure that if I ask to talk to the person in charge, I'll be talking to a person of my race. I can be pretty sure that if I ask to speak to the person in charge, I'll be speaking to a person of my race. My culture gives me little fear about ignoring the perspectives and power of the people of other races. Let me read that one again. My culture gives me little fear about ignoring the perspectives and powers of people of other races. If you're Hispanic and black in this culture, and you don't get training at home about white power and white privilege, that's a part of your upbringing. As whites, we don't need to do that. I can think over many options, social, political, imaginative, or professional, without asking whether a person of my race would ever be accepted or allowed to do what I want to do. Last one. I can choose blemish cover or bandages in flesh color and have them more or less match the color of my skin. This was her reflection on the unearned advantages that dumb ups have. If you're like me, when you heard these, you never considered them until you heard them. The weightless knapsack, okay? Now, this is all leading towards service, right? And how service can help us. In order to get there, we're not there yet, we need to consider there are really two types of advantages. There's positive and negative advantages, and service calls us to know both of them. Let's take a look at them, though, as a prerequisite to talking about service. here's how we ought to deal with positive advantages. If we want to change a culture, if we want to be smart ups, right, and if we want to create a more just culture, this is what we do with positive advantages. Number one, spread them around. You know, you can think about that list and the positive advantages there, being able to go into a supermarket and find the foods that are traditionally your cultural foods. Spread it around, make that more available. So that it's a part of the normal civic fabric that everybody has these advantages. No one is more advantaged than someone else. That's what we try to do, spread them around until they become a part of the normal civic fabric. And until when they're spread around, what they become is unearned entitlements. Does that make sense? No one has to earn them just by virtue of the fact of being human, by being created in God's eyes, that everybody deserved these things, okay? And the ethic that gets us there is the ethic of generosity, okay? The value of generosity is what gets us there. I have some unearned advantages that are positive. The thing I need to do is spread them around until they become a part of the normal civic fabric and become unearned entitlements. All people deserve them. Okay, what do I do with the others? What do I do with the hurtful ones, the negative advantages? As an up, what I need to do is to reject them, okay? If there are advantages that by virtue of my color made life easier for me and in the process really hurt someone else, admission to medical school, can ups learn to reject those in order to eliminate them? If ups continue to accept them, if I continue to ask for unearned advantages that have a negative impact on others, as long as I continue to accept them, I perpetuate them. So how can I learn to give up? What I ask white males, heterosexual white males, is not to give up their power, but to give up their, I also ask them to give up their power, but more so I ask them to give up their privilege, okay? Their unearned negative advantages. Otherwise, they remain unearned advantages, and what we do is we maintain the system that structurally oppresses people of color, okay? And we become dumb ups. The ethic or the value that leads us to that is fairness.
Can you give an example of that? Like something you would ask a heterosexual white male to give up that would be it?
Let me ask the group. Think about that. What is an unearned advantage that we could learn to give up?
Salary differential.
Okay. Check this one out. Let me give you an example because I think that's an excellent point. One of the most inspiring people I've ever met in my life, I met about 6 or 7 months ago, the president of a community college in Montana. The community college is for Native Americans. Her name is Janine Pease Windyboy. She's the president. This is two things they did at the institution in order to create a climate that's more in keeping with their culture. Number one, everybody at the institution earns the same salary, from the president, which is her, to the custodian. The notion is everybody is equal, kind of like at Holden Village. You know, the Waitri earn as much as the Mavericks in a way. You know, who's ever volunteering here gets the same rewards for that. And so somehow the rewards for what you're doing need to become more intrinsic. Here's the other thing they did. They abolished the F grade and replaced it with, I love this concept. They abolished the F grade and they replaced it with forgiveness and generosity. If somebody flunks a course, the institution believes it's their fault. And the student takes the course over again, no charge. Okay? If somebody flunks a course, it's the institution's fault. Either they weren't good enough teachers, or they allowed a student to kind of drift where they should have been doing what they call intrusive advising and to get that student to participate. Okay? Is that? Okay. Good question. Okay, how does service fit in? That's what we need to get to. And I need to talk about two types of service. one I don't want to promote and the other one I do want to promote. The first type of service is what I call the Band-Aid approach, and it's what George Bush calls the 1,000 points of light. Okay? Here's the belief. The belief is that private initiative replaces public responsibility. Let's cut out aid to dependent children. Let's cut out programs that support disadvantaged children in the elementary grades, the Head Start programs. Let's cut out women, infant, and children programs. All of these programs, but let's replace it with private initiative. You know, we don't want these people to be totally taken advantage of. So we'll take away federal support and we'll try to replace it with local private sector support, okay? That's what we're doing. And that's what a lot of the service movements across the country are promoting right now. The purpose? Make ups feel less guilty. People come back from service, gosh, I feel good. You know? I was there feeding the homeless, or feeding the hungry, working with the homeless. Boy, I feel great. And that's the role of service, to perpetuate the system and to do so in a way that allows whites to feel less guilty. Approach, up, down. You're in need, I'm not. I'll come in once a week, drive my car up to the door of the homeless shelter, work with them for a while, change some beds, help give some people a shower, and then go home to my home in the suburbs. I have a home, you don't. I'll be with you for a little while because you help me to feel less guilty, but you need help, I don't. Okay? I think when people think of service, that's the model that's promoted. Here's a model that a number of people actually are trying to promote. It's what I call, as opposed to a Band-Aid approach, it's a holistic approach. The light is the light of Christ. If you're from a different faith tradition other than Christian, the light is that which is your spiritual guide in that tradition. So we act on a transcendent plane. I'm not just working with the people, I'm working on in response to my faith. What's the belief? Get this one, that the poor are our teachers. Smart downs, right? Smart downs have something to teach us about how the world could be made more just. So when I work with the poor, I realize that this is a wonderful opportunity because they're going to teach me about how to be a smart up. If I'll only listen to them, if I'll only get to know them personally, listen to their story, and walk away as a smart up because they've taught me something. That's one of the beliefs. The purpose is to transform society. Probably enough on that. The approach is that we're all sisters and brothers in Christ. It's not an up-down. I'm here with the homeless, okay? Who are my sisters and who are my brothers? Does this make sense, the difference? Okay, let's do one other thing, then we're going to talk some more. Given this approach, which is obviously the approach I want to promote, there's two phases of service. The first phase is what I call direct service. And notice, in direct service, it needs to be mutually beneficial. I'm there to serve, to relieve pain, whether emotional, spiritual, or physical. That's my first goal. But what am I getting, and what am I learning? Am I allowing the poor to be my teacher so that I can become a smart up? The poor as my rabbi, okay? Poor as my teacher. And then what we need to do is smart up reflection. Now, this is what I mean by this. After serving, what I would be wise to do would be to serve with a couple other people or to get to know other people who are serving in the same setting and to get together after having served and to share a simple meal of bread and soup, light a candle, say a prayer, and then ask, what did we learn today? What did the poor teach you? What did the poor teach me? And how can we help each other to become smart ups? So we serve, but really, and to relieve pain, but the other equally important goal is to learn how to become a smart up. Okay. What we need to be able to say, and this is kind of a litmus test. Excuse me.
if you're serving in this way, you'll begin to say, there, but for the grace of God, go I. You'll look at the homeless, you'll look at their lives, you'll look at the poor, you'll look at the hungry, and you'll realize the times in your life when you were teetering on that high wire and someone came into your life and steadied the rope or held you up or called you, you can make it. And somehow we made it across that vulnerable part of our lives and we didn't fall into the pit, we didn't fall into the cycle of poverty. I remember those stories. And we tell those stories to each other, so I can say in my heart of hearts, there but for the grace of God go I. Which is what? Therefore, the homeless and the hungry are my sisters and brothers. I'm not different. It's not an up-down thing. Okay? The first act of service then is an act of reconciliation. I reconnect with my sisters and brothers who are abused by the culture. I reconcile my relationships with them so that they can teach me and so that I can relieve their pain. And then finally, it needs to be an act of repentance. I need to ask myself, how will I be different in this culture? How will I act differently now that I'm a smart up? You know, back to this story here. After having described white privilege, what will I do to lessen or end it? You know, act of repentance. Now that I know, I now don't have a weightless knapsack. My knapsack is real heavy. And what will I do to repent so that I'm spreading them around or rejecting them? Then, that's the first phase of service, direct service. It's the thing, somebody said the most energy-saving device in the world, it only takes one millionth of a volt of electricity, and that is to change our mind. Okay? It's the most cost-saving thing you can do to save the world is to change your mind. And that's what the poor do for us. Okay? Change our mind. The next one is action. After direct service comes action. Political, social, etc. And I need someone to read a passage for me out of Scripture. Would someone be willing to read Exodus 3, 7 through 12?
I will.
Okay. Yeah, now we're talking, just before you read that, we're reading Exodus 3, 7 through 12 to try to see what God thinks about those who are oppressed in the culture and what is our role in relation to them.
Then the Lord said, I have seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings and I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And now behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me, and I have seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppress them. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh that you may bring forth my people, the sons of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt? He said, but I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought forth the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God upon this mountain.
Thank you very much. I love, you know, Moses' response. I'm sure it would have been my response. You know, go to Pharaoh. Who, me? But then, you see, what happens is when we're doing God's work, the beauty is that God becomes our partner. And my sense is, as Al Pitcher has said time and time again, you know, The earth is talking to us. The earth is talking back to us. Cultures are talking back to us. God isn't happy with what's going on. We need to move from cultures that take advantage of people to cultures that spread the advantages around. In Exodus, we learn about two things. God is concerned about Goshen, the starvation in Goshen, and God is also concerned about Pharaoh. So he sends two groups of people out. He sends people to Goshen to do direct service, to minister to those that are hungry, but he also sends Moses to Pharaoh. Sends Moses to Pharaoh and to say, let my people go. My brothers and sisters. Okay? Let my people go. God sends us today to the power structures that be that oppress people. Who are Pharaoh in your community? How am I a Pharaoh? Who do I need to speak to say, let my people go? And as we begin to think about this, this can be overwhelming. And I want to answer a few questions that you might have, but then get us into small groups and to talk about these last three points. I believe if action is going to be successful, number one, it has to have a laser focus. You know, consider all the light in the room at this moment, how diffused it is. It makes it easier for us to see each other, makes it easier for you to see the board. But there's really not a great deal of power in this light because it's so diffused. If we could concentrate all the light in this room and focus it like a laser beam, think about the potential of that energy. And there's so much pain out there. There is so much unearned advantage and so much taking advantage of others that we can become overwhelmed with the choices. So number one, I encourage you to develop a laser focus. What's one thing in your community that you will choose to serve in relation to and that you will choose to act in relation to? It's very, very easy to get. Now, they're all connected. So it'd be great if you could be around a community wherein people are doing different things because you'll teach each other about how they're all connected. It's like Jack went out to work with the poor and now he becomes an expert in low intensity conflict. You never know what the poor are going to teach you and what you'll be asked to proclaim. And then secondly, consistent action. It's really easy to get burned out. How are you going to support yourself? And if you're going to be serving and involved in action, you need a community of people around you that are going to support you in that effort, because you may need to serve for the next 30 years to even make a dent in the particular problem that you're addressing. Inaction, because of the enormity of the task, in my mind, is nothing less than demonic. It's what our culture would like. It's so big, what can I do? Who, me? But we have God with us. And then the final thing you can do along the way, as you're serving in direct service and acting, you will, by role modeling, teach others, and you can begin to bring others along with you. And there's nothing more joyous than that when people start participating in those activities because of your courage. I think ultimately this type of service takes nothing less than moral courage, and it needs to be done in community, and it needs to be done in the context of your faith. Otherwise, I don't think any of us have the strength to continue. Let me stop there. In our remaining time, after some questions, I'd like to get us into small groups and see if you want to spend some time beginning to think about, you know, something that you'll do when you get home. But why don't we just talk for a little bit? So wonderful to give a talk and have violin music in the back there. Katie, did you have something?
Yeah, this is something I always, what are criteria to really try and evaluate work that's going on right now that is really doing it the right way? It's easy. 1,000 points of light and direct service can really be, you can kind of, they can look the same to me sometimes.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's an excellent point. I think, you know, I guess you can take a look at the fruits for one thing. You know, we'll know them by the fruits they bear. You can take a look at the fruits, but I wouldn't be totally, my opinion, not to be totally dependent on that. Somehow I think it's just an intuitive judgment that you need to make. Now I'm thinking about the groups that you might work with. An intuitive judgment about, for you, are their hearts in the right place? And you can begin individual action, you know. My sense is that most shelters, most feeding programs
are trying to be there for the right reason, but what they don't have is enough resources sometimes to do the reflection on service. And for those of you who are good at leading group discussions or at educating, you can offer to do that for them. You know, they may be so busy with direct service. Most people I know working in that sector, you know, it takes so much of their time and energy just to feed the hungry. Who's got time to sit around and talk about what did you learn today? And those direct service people who are out there in the front lines often need your support. One of the things you can do is to volunteer to lead discussions like this to help people understand what it is the poor have taught them. Yeah.
My answer to that question has always been that the most important criteria is probably the hardest one, I think, which is really looking at the relationship between the giver and the person who's being given to. And to what extent, if you have convinced yourself that you're giving and they're taking, it's not right. If you know what you're getting back, if you're conscious and clear what you're getting back is equal, if not greater, than what you're giving, then maybe it's coming close to what you're talking about, Bill.
Excellent point.
It really is, it's that, because my thing that didn't get up on the board because Emily dragged me out of the room about being a dumb up is self-righteousness.
Yeah.
That's what comes up for me when I'm taking advantage. And I think if we find ourselves being self-righteous, we're not giving, you know, that's when we're giving in a way where we feel, you know, we're not.
Justified.
Right. That's a good word for it.
Okay.
I guess the kernel that I'm really trying to get at is that, does anybody know of any organizations that, you know, I mean, are there some organizations that are doing it that might be in other communities that are at least an easy place to
what
start?
Issue are you interested in?
Yeah.
Housing, probably.
I don't know Wenatchee that well. Does anyone know Wenatchee and the housing issues there?
I can tell you ones in the Bay Area.
What I would encourage you to do, Katie, and I think that's an excellent question, I want to refer you all to the resource room. I mean, there's things like the Lutheran Volunteer Corps, if you're at a point in your life where you could take some time and do that, you might want to look at that. Jesuit Volunteer Corps, the Peace Corps, I mean, those are more significant contributions of time. But I've been talking to a couple, an older couple, who are in the village now, who did that for 2 years, went to the Philippines, and it's dramatically changed their lives. In the retirement, they chose to do that. But one of the best places to start, I think, in United Way, at least in the state of Washington, is making a move towards this understanding of service. I've been on a board in the state that's trying to move the state in this direction, and United Way is beginning to understand their role as educators in relation to service. And I would call the United Way of your county and ask them to recommend some agencies.
Oh, Habitat for Humanity, that's a great
Habitat for Humanity is an excellent project. Dan?
I just say that also the Institute for Food and Development Policy, or Food First, for Francis Morapay, is an excellent little book they called Alternatives to the Peace Corps.
Okay.
To try and take these criteria exactly into account in terms of evaluating volunteer opportunities, service opportunities.
What's the name of that again, Dan?
It's called Alternatives to the Peace Corps, I think.
Okay. Do we have a copy in the resource
room? I'm not sure if there is or not. I should check and see.
Okay.
That was San Francisco.
Other questions or reactions? You know, this is overwhelming stuff to me, and the last thing I'd want to do would be to discourage you to, you know, stay with the serving that you're doing now because it's somehow not good enough. What you can do is stay with that organization, but just change it a little bit. And again, I think, you know, that the most important thing we need to do is to change our mind. What do we want out of service? And if you're participating in the Band-Aid approach, my response is great. Good for you. Terrific. You know, and now can you enliven that a little bit more? Can you strengthen that? Can you deepen your commitment? A friend of mine, you know, in talking about service, has a real clear vision about this, said the reward for service is the strength to serve. You know, and if you've served, you know that. Many of you are in professions where you're serving probably on a daily basis. And then I would just say that what you need is a group to work with to say, what am I learning from this service? You know, and how do I want to act differently and be differently in light of that knowledge? Yes.
I think one of the areas in our area of poor is not racial. It's more the senior citizen, widows who are widows of men who are not in a big social security.
Excellent point.
And we do in our church, we try to take care of the widows. When they need a new roof, the men give them, build a new roof.
That's
or
great.
Things like that. And of course, the women do other things for them, but they keep their homes up and they'll do their, fix their cars. And
what's particularly ironic about that is that the research on who takes care of in their late adult years, whether it comes to who takes care of the older parents or the women, 90%, I mean, there have been studies of who are the actual people who put in the time to take care of the elderly, and it's women, and yet when they get to be elderly, who's left to take care of them?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, in our community, we have a good senior citizen program going, but my husband realized that the people who are neglected are
she's fine, don't worry about it.
Are the frail seniors. The ones who are able to go and dance and go on field trips and things, well, we've got a good social program for them going in the town.
Yeah.
But the people who aren't able to do this are left out.
Yeah.
And many of them are parents of people who work and who need time off.
This is, you know, you're making an excellent point, I think, both of you. And just like, the, you know, for those of you who live in the big city, this will be more, maybe this will make more sense. Have you ever heard someone say, homeless? Do we have homeless? You know, I don't notice them. You know, they are invisible. You know, I think we use that word here. We hear it down, sometimes we feel invisible. One of the things that goes on again, I really believe in my heart of hearts, is this notion of psychological numbing. We choose not to see things. You know, one of the best things you could do in your church or in your family is to do a kind of community assessment. Whose needs are going unmet? Who's being taken advantage of in this culture that are somehow not being served? One of the things you can do if you're talented organizing, if you're talented at helping people to get inspired, is to do an assessment. That's okay. Here, there you go. It's to do an assessment of whose needs are being unmet, and then try to just make people aware of that. You know, you can go to your county agency, and you can direct people towards those new opportunities for service. But allowing the poor to be invisible is one of the ways we cope with that. And now I have to tell you, if you're not involved in service, and if you do this, one of the things I need to forewarn you is that you will begin to see real clearly things you've never seen before. And you ought to go in knowing that. You know, I don't want to blindside you. You ought to go in knowing if you really commit your hearts to service, you're going to begin to see the world in a totally different light, and your life will never be the same.
Well, just talking about what you were just bringing up, we paired in our church and started calling people who were shut-ins. And then, you know, we started visiting those people. And now, you know, some of us have been visiting constantly with those same people, and we have really good friendships with them, and take them shopping or whatever needs to be done. Maybe something like that would also
work. Well, my husband went to the board, the city board, and asked them to fund what they call a Fitzgerald House, which is a place that will take Alzheimer's people, and also will do daycare for the fragile seniors.
Yeah.
And they passed on it. I mean, and they're actually funding it. just with a little initiative and...
You bet. Let me leave you with one last point, which, and then if you want to talk some more afterwards, I'll hang around. But studies have demonstrated that to be rich and in America, it's the best country to live in. If you want to be very rich, America's the place you'd want to choose to live. Because chief executive officers of organizations sometimes earn 100 to 200 times what the average earner makes. Take a look at people like, you know, Michael Eisner, for instance, the new CEO of the Disney Corporation. His salary is about 300 times higher than the average citizen. The United States, unfortunately, is the worst place. When you think about that, the American culture is in some serious need of strengthening. Because in my mind, a culture is evaluated on how great it is by how well it treats the least of these, you know? And in our culture, the least of these are homeless and hungry and lonely, and we need to work on that. Thanks.